from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, while traveling to Ghana on a Stanford Research Fellowship, Yah Jesse visited the Cape Coast Castle, where she learned about the role Africans played in perpetuating the transatlantic slave trade. This knowledge became the impetus for her debut novel, Homegoing, which chronicles the lives of two Ghanaian sisters and their experiences of slavery. We'll speak with the Berkeley-based author about the novel, which has been named the New York Times Notable Book for 2016. Join us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's Forum program. Yah Jesse's highly praised debut novel, Homegoing, covers seven generations and three centuries of two African half-sisters and their descendants. Born in Ghana and raised in Huntsville, Alabama, Yah Jesse graduated from Stanford and then completed an MFA at the Iowa Writers' Workshop under a Dean's Graduate Research Fellowship. She presently resides in Berkeley, and she joins us for this Forum Hour. And welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Delighted to have you. And this is an extraordinary achievement, this book, especially for a debut novel. And congratulations on it.
Thank you.
I'd like to begin by talking with you about the genesis of it. I mean, you actually left Ghana when you were 2 years old, but you went back and visited an old fort, which was a symbol of slavery. It kind of gives new meaning to upstairs, downstairs, and we'll talk about that.
Right.
But it's on the Gold Coast, and it's really sort of the genesis of this novel, wasn't it?
Yeah. So in 2009, my sophomore year at Stanford, I received a fellowship called the Chapeluji that they give to sophomore students to complete a research or creative project between their sophomore and junior years. And I knew I wanted to use mine to write a novel. I'd had a different idea in mind initially. I thought I'd go to my mother's hometown, which is in the central region of Ghana, a place that I hadn't spent very much time in, and just kind of see if anything struck me. Nothing really did, but a friend came to visit and kind of, you know, in thinking of more touristy things to do with him, we decided to go see the Cape Coast Castle, which was something that I had never done before, never really paid much thought to before. Obama was actually in Ghana that summer, too, and he had just visited it. So I think that was where the idea kind of came from. But it was while in the castle on this tour that the tour guide started to talk to us about how the British soldiers who lived and worked in the castle used to marry the local women, which was something I didn't know anything about. And then from there, he took us down to see the dungeons. And I pretty much immediately knew that this was what I wanted to write about.
This was the genesis, really, of the novel. Did you know that you'd want to write also about the slave trade and particularly the controversial subject of the complicity of tribal members in the slave trade?
Yes, I think so. I mean, the tour guide, I think, did an excellent job of kind of talking to us about different Ghanaian ethnic groups' involvement in the slave trade. And, you know, myself, my family, my mother is Afanti and my father is an Ashanti. So those are the two groups that I focus on in the book. And those are the two that the tour guide kind of talked to us most about, in part because we were in Fanti land at the time. And it was just so fascinating to me that my mother could have grown up, you know, 50 miles from this castle and never really engaged with slavery in a kind of meaningful way, a way that was meaningful enough to kind of have discussions with her children about it. That struck me as odd, I guess, having grown up here where you do learn about slavery in school versus Ghana where you don't. And I felt like, you know, to have this monument to slavery be on Ghanaian land, but not really talk about the Ghanaians' role in building and maintaining it felt like it would kind of do a disservice to the novel.
And where did the idea of two sisters, half-sisters, come from? I mean, because they don't hardly even know of each other, but
right.
There's a great sense of an epic here because it goes on from generation to generation, and you begin with these two who have totally different trajectories in terms of their relationship to slavery.
Yes. I mean, the idea for the two sisters came about during that tour. Again, when the tour guide talked to us about how the British soldiers married local women, I think that was maybe my first realization that there was some kind of connection between the locals and the British in any kind of meaningful way. And so I was really struck by the idea that there could be these free Ghanaian women walking above these captives underneath, and the idea that two of them could be related felt really interesting to me, and to kind of be able to watch that family line split off and see the directions that it might take.
So you just followed your curiosity and your imagination.
Exactly right.
But you did a lot of research, and I want to get into some of that here. In fact, I mean, you know, it begins, and a lot of novelists write about a novel beginning with an image, and you begin by telling us about this fire.
Yes.
One of the sisters' father is preserving the yams, and, you know, just
right. In
those kinds of details. I mean, the raising of yams, the marrying off of daughters, the way the multiple wives were in separate huts, all
yeah.
of the kinds of things that men in trying to find a wife would bring, like the fish in their nets
right.
and so
yeah.
forth. I mean, a lot of research.
Yeah, yeah. This book took an incredible amount of research. I think, in fact, during that trip to Ghana, in my journal on the first day, I wrote something like, I'm scared of how much research this book is going to take. So I was kind of aware.
How did you overcome that daunting fear?
I just took it one step at a time. You know, it took me 7 years to write, and I wrote it chronologically, and I did that so that I could kind of break up each generation and kind of figure out how to go about researching that particular section. So so it didn't overwhelm me. I didn't try to, you know, do it all at once and then write from there. I did it as I went along.
Well, you take us into a lot of human places, but also a lot of dark places. I mean,
right.
misogyny and racism and slavery, and also early on domestic violence. I mean, where
right.
Man is beating his wife and his wife is beating the kid, and
yeah.
so it goes. How did that come from the research, or did it come more from, you know, what you read in the newspapers day after day?
Right. I mean, I think it was a combination of both. I knew pretty early on that I wanted this book to be about the legacy of slavery, not just slavery in the 18th century, but also kind of what slavery has left us today, both for Ghanaians and Americans. And because of that, I knew that I would be going into ideas of racism and misogyny and those kinds of aspects that kind of trail off from something this big. But yeah, I think it was a combination of, again, my curiosities and things that I've read about and things that I've heard of, and also just kind of paying attention to human stories.
But the breadth and the scope of the novel is really what astounded me as a reader. I mean, you have not only the legacy of slavery, and I'm suspecting you probably read Isabel Wilkerson, because you
yes.
take us all the way. You take us from Middle Passage. You take us to Harlem. You take us, you know, to the heroin addiction in Harlem and so
right.
forth, to the Great Migration that Wilkerson writes about. The scope of this is epic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I did read Wilkerson actually after I'd finished the novel, ironically enough. But yeah, I loved the idea of having a book that kind of made an attempt to connect the dots in a way that makes it clear that so many of the things that we're seeing in the present didn't appear out of thin air. You know, they kind of have these precedences. And so for me, writers like Wilkerson with her book, The Warmth of Other Suns, and also Michelle Alexander with The New Jim Crow, and something like Ta-Nehisi Coates' The Case for Reparations, these writers who are taking a more long view of history was something that really fascinated me and something that I hoped to do with this book.
Yeah, you were kind of fascinated and surprised and probably delighted when Ta-Nehisi Coates wrote something about you.
Oh, yeah. That was one of the highlights of this year, certainly, was seeing seeing that blurb from Ta-Nehisi. I had no idea that he even had the book. And so I think I first encountered it when he was tweeting about it. A friend texted my boyfriend, and we ended up on Twitter just going through his kind of live tweets of his reading experience. It was pretty incredible.
What a great feeling, especially since it was a surprise. It's almost
yes.
I don't know what would be more comparable, except maybe when LeVar Burton sent you a signed certificate for a story you wrote. Let's go back to that for a moment, because a lot of listeners are perhaps too young to remember even the name LeVar Burton, but he was the star of Roots, you know, which had an enormous impact on television land and on American TV watchers, probably on you too.
I actually have never seen Roots, so I have to say LeVar Burton for me was heroic because of his work in Reading Rainbow, which I used to watch every day religiously. We didn't have cable growing up, so I really could only watch the PBS show. And I remember
it's probably maybe made you a better writer.
I'm pretty sure it did. But I loved reading so much, and I loved that program so much. And they had a competition called the Reading Rainbow Young Writers and Illustrators Competition. And I wrote a story for it when I was 7. It's called Just Me and My Dog. And LeVar Burton signed a certificate and sent it back to me. And I think that was really kind of, you know, the beginnings of all of this for me.
You get that validation, sets you in motion.
Yeah, exactly.
Growing up in Alabama, though, I mean, let's talk about that. Because, you know, the legacies in Alabama that you grew up with, I mean, you must have to some extent absorbed some of them under the Wallace years. I mean, you're too young for that, but certainly... Yeah. The whole realization that this was a Jim Crow society and this was a separatist society.
Right. Yeah. I mean, we moved to Alabama when I was 9, actually. So we had lived in from Ghana. We went to Ohio, Columbus, Ohio, and then Illinois, Tennessee, and then Alabama. And I think the first thing that struck me and my family about being in Alabama was just kind of the lack of West African immigrants, because in every place prior, we'd at least had some like large community of other Ghanaians, other Nigerians to be around. And in Alabama, there was this kind of absence of that. And then on top of that, we ended up living in a predominantly white neighborhood. So it was also our first time of isolation by race, too. So isolated by race and isolated by ethnicity. And I think very early on, I started to realize that Alabama was unlike any of the other places I had lived in, just because of the fact that it is one of those places where the legacy of slavery is still so strongly felt. And so that kind of, I think, set into motion, I guess, a lot of the questions and the things that I interrogate in this book.
If you've just joined us, we're talking to Jessie, and her debut novel is Homegoing, and it's been much praised, and it was a notable book on the New York Times list for the year 2016. You used the word interrogate. I mean, do you see yourself as an interrogator? And I mean, it's a strong word connotatively.
Yeah, I think one of the great things that writing can do is to interrogate, to kind of ask questions, not necessarily to answer them, but to kind of lay bare all of these questions that you might have. And for me, I think Homegoing is really kind of just a mixture of so many of the questions that I've had growing up about race, about ethnicity, about time, and writing in a way, again, that doesn't really answer those questions, but that attempts to ask them.
Well, a good novel does that. I mean, it presses us with all kinds of pressing questions. Let me ask you about answers, though, just for a moment, because it used to be that novelists were asked their opinion about just everything. I mean, they were often, well-trained at giving responses and all the research you've done. Where do you have a position? I'm just going to ask you forthrightly about whether reparations should be paid because of slavery, because you've delved so deeply into the legacy of slavery, you immerse yourself into it.
Yes, I mean, I think that reparations should be paid. I think, obviously, again, the case for reparations that Ta-Nehisi Coates, I think, was a very convincing piece, and I think one of the reasons why it's important is because it lays out the ways in which we have not addressed slavery properly in this country, and so much of what we're seeing in the present, I think, are these offshoots of horrible policy that's lasted over not just decades but centuries. And in order to try to begin to make amends for that, or to begin to kind of change the direction, the course of race relations in this country, I think, you know, we have to make an actual kind of physical manifestation of progress, and reparations could be that.
Although the difficulty is how much reparations, and if you give reparations to Africans, do you give reparations to Native Americans?
Sure. It raises a bunch of other questions, but I think it should at least be considered.
And I couldn't help thinking, especially in reading the novel when it takes place in Africa, of Chinua Achebe, and I don't know if he was an influence on you, but I suspect you mentioned Ghana and Nigeria together and so forth. Had you read Achebe?
Yes, I did. I read Things Fall Apart in college, I believe, and it's, you know, it's one of the great pieces of literature, for any country, but certainly for Nigerians, for West Africans, Achebe is kind of, the standard of what West African literature can be. And I adored that book.
He's a great icon of that. You also adored Marquez's book.
Yes.
Big influence on you, too.
Yes. I read 100 Years of Solitude right before I set out to write this book. And one of the great gifts of that novel for a writer, I think, is that you feel as though Garcia Marquez is so free. You know, he's expansive and he kind of allows himself to try new things, to do things that you probably would be told in a writing class to never do, such as naming every character the same name.
Well, Faulkner does that too.
Faulkner does that too.
Sound and the Fury, Quentin and Quentin.
Right.
But so you were kind of moving against the grain of conventional codes there in your mind?
Well, I was hoping to. I knew that I was writing a book that that would take place over such a long time period. And not only that, not only to have like a multi-generational perspective, but a book that kind of marches forward in time and never goes back. And that was something that I didn't really know how to do. And so 100 Years of Solitude was great in that I felt like it was a way of taking permission, I guess.
I guess we're getting into the whole realm of literary influences. And for people who are not necessarily acquainted with some of these works, that may not necessarily be as exciting for those who are. But I couldn't help thinking of Toni Morrison reading you, too, particularly Song of Solomon.
Yeah. Song of Solomon is my favorite book, I think, of all time. I read it when I was 17 in an AP literature class in Alabama. And it was the first book by a black woman that I had ever been assigned and really that I had ever read. And so I was so struck by, first of all, by the fact that people who looked like me could have this profession that I had kind of thought about my whole life, but never really understood that that you could do it for a living. And so that amazed me. And then just the sheer power and beauty of that book really struck me. And she's a big influence on me.
And I was struck by a number of things, but let me go back to Africa and the slave trade. When Afia, for example, who opens the novel, first lays eyes on a white man, I mean, you're there. You are seeing things from her point of view, and you're making a reader see things from her point of view. It's the first white man she's ever laid eyes on.
Right.
And the idea of, I mean, it's almost like Brave New World or something along those lines. It's arresting to her, and it's arresting to us as readers. How do you put yourself in that kind of mindset?
Right. I mean, that's the great challenge, I think, of writing characters, to figure out how to inhabit, I guess, the world of your character in a way that allows the reader to inhabit that world. And for Afia, I think one of the things that I was thinking about was the fact that, you know, she's living in this kind of isolated village, but this village that is attempting to kind of become greater. And in becoming greater, it's decided to be a part of the slave trade. And so that kind of puts her and her village in contact with white people for the first time in a significant way. And so that's kind of where I start, is thinking about what that might feel like, what that might mean, and go from there.
You also build up suspense early on. I mean, a reader would wonder why her mother was keeping her from revealing menstruation.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Was it deliberate to sort of keep the suspense in there as to why she was doing that?
Yes, it was. It was deliberate. You know, I didn't want to kind of give away how the two first characters, Afia and Essie, were related. And I felt like, you know, if I talked too openly about why Baba, Afia's mother, made that choice, it might kind of give something away a little earlier than I wanted to.
You really seem to be also very set on giving these characters a kind of full dimensionality. By that, I mean E.M. Forster a long time ago in Aspects of the Novel. And I think this is, by the way, is this a novel or a number of short stories interrelated? I think you could make the latter argument, couldn't you?
Some people have. For me, it was always a novel. It was always novelistic in scope, and I never imagined it as a collection of short stories.
But I was talking about Forrester because he talks about rounded characters, making the characters multidimensional, giving them nuance, giving them really sometimes very contradictory traits and traits which in some instances as a reader, thoughtful reader, really disapproves of and strongly disapproves of.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't want any character in this book to be black or white, you know, or to have this kind of this moralistic way of saying these are the good people and these are the bad people. I felt like that isn't true. That isn't true to human nature at all. So you can have a character like Governor James, who is the governor of this Cape Coast castle, who is kind of the one who is deciding who and where to sell these slaves to. And so in that way, he's kind of a dark figure. And yet when you see the way that he loves his wife, Afia, for example, he becomes more complicated and that character kind of gains depth. And so thinking about that there are people who are both good and bad, who make decisions that they think are right for reasons that we understand, even if we don't understand the decisions themselves. I think that's one way to kind of get to rounding out a character.
You know, there are those who would argue, you know, any slave owner should be presented as Simon Legree or some dreadful character. But Thomas Jefferson was a slave owner. I mean, you know, there's all that sense of a complicated nature of humanity. And I think you get at that in a really original and thoughtful way. You get criticized, though, for essentially revealing the African complicity in the slave trade. Have you heard any blowback on that?
Oh, yes. There's certainly been pushback to that, I think, particularly, again, among West Africans who aren't used to having that information kind of out there. And I understand the impulse in part because there is a fear, I guess, that that people can use that to kind of blame you for the slave trade and kind of shift the blame. But I don't see it that way. I see it as a way of kind of, again, complicating the narrative. And if this truth exists, why should it be hidden?
Well, there has been a lot of argument about that, as I'm sure you know, by scholars. I'm thinking about people like Henry Louis Gates and Cornel West, about just how much that complicity ought to be brought into the light, and especially in light of black nationalism. It's not only African, of course, it's African-American.
Right, yeah. I mean, for me, I think trying to keep in mind the fact that even while these Gold Coast people were exploiting each other, they were simultaneously being exploited. That kind of nuance, that kind of complexity of the situation, I think, is important to recognize, so that you're not just simply ascribing blame to one party or the other.
If you've just joined us, we are talking to Yaa Jessie, and her novel, it's a debut novel, is Homegoing. We do welcome your involvement in the program. If you've read the novel, or even if you haven't read the novel, you may want to join us with some thoughts or questions or comments. And let us know what's on your mind in terms of this conversation. Our toll-free number is available right now. It's 866-733-6786. We welcome your phone call, so feel free to join us. Again, you can do that at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Many ways you can join the program. We do invite you to do so. You can also go to our Facebook page. Again, we're talking to Yaa Jessie. She's a Berkeley resident now. And talk about this this novel and also the Six Figure Advance. I want to get to that when we return. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking this hour with Yaa Jessie here in studio with us, author of Homegoing, which is her debut novel. And as I've been saying, it has quite an extraordinary sweep to us. It takes us from the slave trade back in the 18th century in Africa and the way people were living and the way the slave trade was operating on a transatlantic level, and also to America and to the shores of America, and also to such historical major historical events like the Fugitive Slave Act, but also, of course, to the Jim Crow system in the South and the kind of slavery that existed here as well. And we do invite your involvement in the program. Jesse visited the Cape Coast Castle, where she learned about the role that Africans played in perpetuating the transatlantic slave trade, and that knowledge became, as we've identified, the impetus for this debut novel. I was asking her off-air about Alice Walker's novel, which I know many listeners know, The Color Purple, because there are two sisters in that, and they go on these totally different odysseys and trajectories, but maybe slight unconscious influence, but not conscious.
Right. Huh? Yeah.
Let me ask you, though, about this, because when a debut novel gets a large advance like you did, and, you know, it's wonderful to get that kind of advance, giving you the freedom to write full time.
Right.
But there's a lot of envy from other writers, I think, and it's I think you described it as a double-edged sword. You've got that on the and maybe even harsher expectations for you as a novelist.
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, a lot of novels that come out you know, to this kind of blank slate. So they're not there aren't these expectations, these ideas of how good it might or might be or might not be kind of floating around before the novel comes out. And for books that do kind of gain this kind of attention because of their advances, I think there often is that that weight of expectation hanging off of it. For good and for better and for worse, I think.
Were you surprised, though, that, you know, that kind of advance was put to you? I mean, obviously you had a good agent, but, you know, it's a pretty sizable advance.
Oh, yeah. I was completely surprised. I mean, I think any writer will tell you about the great amounts of rejection that they face. And for me, so many agents had said no to this book before I ended up signing with my agent that even the fact of getting an agent and selling it at all seemed like a miracle to me. And so to have received the advance that I did seemed, you know, like whatever is past a miracle, you know.
Is the agent someone from out here, or how'd you find the agent?
My agent is Eric Simonoff. He's in New York. And I found him kind of the old fashioned way, just by looking at books and writers that I admired and noting who their agents were and sending him a cold email that he very, very graciously responded to.
Who does he represent besides you?
He represents Jhumpa Lahiri and Edward P. Jones, ZZ Packer.
Boy, that's great company to be in.
Exactly, yeah. Writers I adore.
You know, Lahiri lives in Italy now and has started writing in Italian.
Yes,
it's kind of
yeah.
unusual that she would do something like that. And she's a wonderful writer. So is Jones.
Yeah.
Who else did you mention?
ZZ Packer.
Yeah, well, she's booked on Forum. I've been to make
wonderful.
Note of that. I think she's... no, I'm sorry. It's not Zadie Spagger. She's been on Forum, but Zadie Smith is going to be on Forum.
Oh, right.
I just want to get that in the mix here, too.
Wonderful.
A listener wants to know if you finished your degree, given the large advance.
Yes, I did finish my degree. I finished my degree before I sold the book. So I graduated from Iowa in 2014 and sold the book in 2015.
Still a great writer's workshop, Iowa, isn't it?
Yeah, it's wonderful.
It managed to sustain that quality for all these years now.
Yeah.
Carl tweets, most of the exported slaves were not from the local tribes or even Ghana. Perhaps it made it easier for them to be thought of as the other.
Well, I think that has something to do with this. A lot of times I'll hear people say things like, I can't believe that Africans sold each other. And that assumes this kind of connectivity or this idea of thinking about Africans as having an each other. And I think for many people, certainly on the Gold Coast at that time, they were used to thinking about their different ethnic groups, not necessarily thinking in a racial way that kind of blended all Black people together. And so you could sell those people over there and not think about it as having anything to do with you and your people here. So I think that, again, kind of makes the situation a little more complex than maybe we're used to thinking about it here in America, where things are very racially configured.
Do you follow, like, Ghana politics? Do you keep up with current events in Ghana at
I don't,
all?
Not
or,
really.
Or Africa generally?
No. Not enough. Yeah.
Here's a listener, Ben, who writes, many times when I have read about or saw pictures of the Holocaust, I was overwhelmed to the point where I had to remove myself from subject matter. Did you ever get overwhelmed with the facts of the brutality of slavery in both Africa and the United States?
Absolutely. I mean, I always say getting to write the novel was the kind of relief, because at least when I was writing, I can console myself with the fact that it was fiction, that nothing I was putting on the page was real.
But fiction has truth to it,
but as fiction
I'm sure
has
you know
truth.
As a novelist. And yeah. I'm thinking about James Joyce's remark that history is a nightmare from which we're all trying to escape.
Yes, exactly. And the research, I think, was the part that really overwhelmed me and kind of filled me with grief, because I didn't have that kind of that shelter of fiction. You know, I knew that what I was reading about was real, had really happened to people. And so for every kind of dark or traumatic moment in Homegoing, there is this kind of counterpoint moment that happened in real life to a real person, oftentimes much darker than even in the book.
So in vivifying it, you went through a grieving process. Is that what you're saying?
I think so. I mean, I think that trip to the castle was certainly the most grief-filled I've ever felt. Just standing in that dungeon in a room that still smells even after all these years, and kind of imagining the fact that people were actually kept in this space filled me with an immense amount of grief.
Let's go to our callers. Let's welcome first Ellen. You're on the air.
I am.
Yeah, go ahead, Ellen. You're with us. Good morning.
Sorry. Good morning. I'm listening with tears in my eyes. I'm a retired reporter. And for 40 years, I worked in a newsroom. And I remember so well how the dearth of Black writers achieving the kind of access and prominence that your guest has had. So I would like for her to talk to us a little bit more about her research process and her writing process. It sounds like such a daunting task, given the amount of travel and maintaining a journal and then putting it all together. At 75, I'm working on my second book, and I'm really interested to hear more about her process.
Thank you for the question, Ellen. Yeah, you want to talk about your research process?
Sure. So I didn't outline this novel, but I did make a family tree that looks a lot like the one that's at the front of the book now, except my tree also had the dates that each chapter would be taking place in, and then one thing that was happening politically or historically in the background during that time period. So something like the Fugitive Slave Act or the Assiniboia War, or sometimes it was as vague and as broad as Reconstruction/Jim Crow. And then I began each chapter by just researching whatever that thing was in the background to kind of just give me a sense of what my characters might be dealing with on a larger scale. And I really felt strongly that the research should be atmospheric and kind of backgrounded, so that you didn't feel while you were reading as though you were just getting a history lesson about the Assiniboia War, but rather you got to kind of see the characters interacting with that.
You also knew how to keep your reader in suspense, as I indicated earlier.
Right.
Were you in suspense in the process too?
I was in suspense, I think, because I didn't outline. You know, I was kind of allowing myself to react to the story as it happened, and writing chronologically helped me do that as well, because after I wrote a character, I would better kind of understand who the character's child might be, where they might be living. So those kinds of questions opened up as I went along.
There's a comment from Kevin on research. He writes, the scholar here is intelligent and qualified. Nice to be called a scholar.
Mm.
Novelist scholar. But I can say for a fact that the material that comprised her research was itself a product of a Western legacy of convoluting or melanated past by way of omission. While African nations did participate in slavery, it was still under the auspices of an existing colonial construct and financed by the same people who would finance and thus perpetuate the coming century of world warfare.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I think the book talks not only about slavery, but also about colonialism. And I knew going into this book, first of all, that I don't identify as a scholar or as an academic, but rather as a storyteller. And I'm attempting to write about 250 years of Ghanaian and American history through story. And in so doing, there are things that I have to privilege, things that I have to talk about more than other things. That's just the nature of writing fiction.
We'll go to more calls for you. Let me go next to Oakland, and we'll welcome Coca Voodoo. Good morning.
Hello. Good morning. I was listening to your program this morning, Michael, and your guest, and it's a very interesting and provocative book that she's written. And I heard her say something about helping to make amends, and she spoke to the issue about African-Americans and how they felt about continental Africans' complicity in the slave trade. And perhaps her book, and especially in some sections of it, could help West Africans to a higher consciousness about the issue, and also perhaps to help them to atone for their involvement in the transatlantic slave trade. And through that atonement, paved the way for a greater sense of reparations or acknowledgement for the damage that was done by this terrible slave trade and its long-stand lingering effects, which cover a span of 400 or 500 years or so. So,
what would that, Kokavulu? Let me go to the point you're making here. What would that atonement? How do you envision that? What is it going to be?
The atonement by getting continental West Africans to acknowledge their involvement in the slave trade. And through that acknowledgement, you know, and some attempt to atone for it could be the basis for a new understanding amongst African Americans and West Africans, and also lead to a sense of solution to the long-standing issue of racism brought on by the transatlantic slave trade itself. And
let me go to Jesse on this. Of course, you might get West Africans saying the same thing that many Southerners or Americans would say, that was generations ago. You mm-hmm. know, what can we atone for what our ancestors have done? You know, that has nothing to do with us personally. And what do you say in response to his notion of atonement here?
Well, I think before atonement can even happen, acknowledgement has to happen. And as I said before, I think for so many, at least of the older Ghanaians that I know, This history isn't something that they even know very much about. You know, they haven't really been exposed to it in school. My own parents have read the novel now and talked to me about how much they've learned just through reading it. So I think that's one thing, hopefully, that homegoing can do is first to just kind of expose this history, bring it up in a way that allows people to acknowledge it. And then from there, perhaps other steps can be taken too to atone.
Same applies, though, to Americans. I mean,
sure,
they're ignorant, many of them, of slavery and just,
sure,
you know, the things you write about.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, let me thank the caller. And we'll hear from more of our listeners. Let me go next to Redwood City. Tracy, join us. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for writing this very important book. I just want to say I'm a Caucasian mom with two high school girls, and I started the book, and I found it made me so uncomfortable, I had to put it down for a while. I do want to continue it, but not only because your story is dealing with brutality of people against people and Africans participating in the slave trade, but as a woman, it made me feel really uncomfortable because of how women have been treated and still are treated around the world. Right. And as an example of that is like what happened in our own local area during the Super Bowl, and that not, you know, the fact that sex trade is alive and well through the Port of Oakland. I just really found your book difficult and good, you know, it's raising this. What do you think of it? Because I know there's so many different issues you're talking about. What about this issue?
Yes, I mean, I certainly wanted to focus on the lives of women in this book. In part, the book begins with two women because my people, the Akan people, are matrilineal. And so I knew if I was going to write a book about a Gold Coast family, I needed to start with the women. And thinking about how much agency a woman might have had in the 18th century, as I mentioned, I learned on the tour about how the local women would sometimes marry these British soldiers. And I thought, how much choice did they have in doing that? You know, did they want to be doing this or did they have to? And kind of beginning to think about just agency and whether or not women had it and whether or not they do.
It's how they become commodities. I mean, they become goods. In fact, your lead character is so lighter skinned that she becomes even more desirable because of her lighter skin. So there's that as well. And you always have the women waiting on the men and doing all the things, I mean, you know, being essentially subaltern and without agency where men are concerned. It's a patriarchy.
Exactly. The mixture of the patriarchy. I mean, commodities is the perfect word because that's also how these slaves were being viewed. Right. So this kind of mix of slavery and misogyny and who gets to kind of control their own fate, I think is something that that I was thinking about quite a bit during.
What do you tell the reader, though, who may say, I mean, there's a lot of humanity in your novel, but there's a lot of darkness and a lot of difficulty to struggle with. You want people to be educated, but at the same time, you want them to some extent to immerse themselves in the world that you've created. So give them a boost here. What do you say?
I mean, there's still a lot of light in this book. I think in part just the fact that that these generations do persist, that they do survive, that so many of these characters, even after having gone through circumstances that are hard for us to even fathom, they persist and they kind of create the life that they want to see for their children to be able to persist. And that idea of familial love, romantic love, just love in general, I think is something that is coming up chapter after chapter.
There's a triumphant sense of love. I'm glad you pinpointed that because I felt that way as a reader. I also was just struck by, getting back to the role of women and so forth, there's a continuity. Take it all the way up to Their Eyes Were Watching God. I mean, Zora Neale Hurston, who I imagine was also an influential writer in your growth as a writer.
I loved Zora Neale Hurston's work, Their Eyes Were Watching God, and also Dust Tracks on a Road.
And she went out like you did. I mean, you went to Ghana, you got the inspiration. She went out and met the people and so forth. She was like...
Her work was very anthropological, I think. You know, she had an interest...
She was an anthropologist.
Right.
A Columbia anthropologist.
Right.
Also a Republican, which a lot of people don't know.
I did not know that.
Let me bring some more callers on here, and we go to Lynn. Lynn, you're on the air.
Hi, this is Lynn calling from Talisman. I was in Talisman at Stanford with Yaw, is a group where we where we would sing a cappella music about the African diaspora. And I wanted to ask you how your experience as a musician, and specifically, you know, as a musician focusing on music from the African diaspora, how that played into your process throughout your book. There's a lot of words that just reflect poetry and reflect music.
I mean,
what do you play?
I don't play. I used to sing. As Lynn said, I was in a group called Talisman at Stanford, which is an a cappella group that focused on music from the African and African American diaspora. And I think one thing that Talisman did do for me is that it was kind of one of the first times that I was ever exposed to ideas about diaspora in general, ways of kind of connecting the Black experience across oceans, across continents. And so I think that certainly is something that comes up in the book. As far as the musicality of the book, something that I always do when I write is that I read all of my work aloud, which is kind of tedious, but I think that I like the idea of kind of being able to listen to the rhythm of a sentence in order to know whether or not it's right, and to kind of connect these moments, these kind of notes, I suppose you could compare them to.
No wonder it took you years to write.
Yeah, I know. It's a very tedious thing to do. And yet I don't think I would have done it if I wasn't a lover of music.
Well, the language soars in many instances. I mean, you can almost hear the poetic cadence of what you capture here. And here are some comments from listeners about your book, which I think you'll like. Maddie says, I loved Homegoing. Adele writes, beautiful book. Thank you, thank you. And Jamil writes, so glad you have Jesse on. I read her book in our Brown Girls Book Club and enjoyed the well-written novel.
Yeah.
Let me thank the last caller, Lynn, and go to more of your calls here. Let's go to Oakland. Vicki, you're on the air. Morning.
Yes. Hi.
Hi.
I was a student teacher in Berkeley back in the mid-70s when the Roots program came out, and we tried to develop some curriculum around that in the elementary school classroom. But in my own teacher program, I found that there was a great deal of resistance to the concept of, you know, many historical examples of man's inhumanity to man and the idea that tribalism is not, specific to race. And I'm wondering if Ms. Jesse has encountered any criticism, not necessarily about the historical accuracy, but sort of the relative culpability and whether or not it should be pointed out that there that it can be a question of, you know, morals, which humans have, you know, morals and the lack thereof that humans are you know, prone to.
I think I've received criticism around ideas of you know, the different ethnic groups warring against each other and what that might mean in terms of, I suppose, in terms of like a moralistic, I guess, view of the slave trade.
And forgive me, not only that, but, you know, tribes stalking slaves in competition with other tribes. You know?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. I think all of those kinds of questions have come up in response to this book. Again, it's hard to do as a fiction writer, I think, to kind of encapsulate every single aspect of something. But at the back of the book, I do list all of my sources, and I think that's one great place to start, is to kind of read those nonfiction books that I used in order to research this book.
Well, here's a listener, and let me thank the last caller, Vicki, for that call. George, who actually went to high school in Ghana. Go ahead, George. You're on the air.
Yes, this is George. I went to the high school in Ghana in the 60s, early 60s, and I wanted to make a comment about when Nkrumah and one of his successors, Jerry Rawlings, the president, one of the problems they had was downplaying tribalism, which I think led to the free trade of slaves, to nationalism by being Ghanaian, and they didn't want to downplay tribalism too much because that's part of the roots of the people. At the same time, they had to come together as nationalism. So I wanted to know her comments about the slave trade and tribalism.
I mean, for me, I have to say again, my father is an Ashanti and my mother is a Fanti. And so I kind of grew up toggling these two different ethnic groups, these two different lines. And I know very well how much pride people still do take in their own personal ethnic group. And there has been, I think, a lot of resistance to the idea of thinking nationalistically, of thinking I'm a Ghanaian first. If you asked my father, you know, to kind of identify himself, I think he would first say that he was an Ashanti, and then he would say Ghanaian. That concept, I think, is difficult for some people to grasp, particularly Americans, because we don't have that kind of way of associating ourselves. But it's still very much present, and it's something that I hoped to kind of bring out in the book as well.
How did your parents get together?
My father was my mother's teacher, actually, in college.
Let me thank the caller and go to more of your calls. We go to Dan in Santa Clara. Dan, you're on.
Yes, hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Welcome.
Yeah. Haven't read the book, heard a bit of the buzz. Some of my friends said, check it out. After listening to this program, I want to thank you, Mr. Krasny, because I'm pretty psyched about curling up with it. My wife's away for the holiday. I'm going to read right through it. Really looking forward to it. I'm really looking forward to it because literature is the place to work this out. We may have disagreements as to who's to blame and how much and all that stuff, but we got to keep talking about it. And this work is something I'm really looking forward to, and I hope we continue the conversation.
Okay. Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you for joining the conversation. Appreciate those words. And let me go to another caller, Scott in Sonoma. You're on. Morning.
Hi. Thank you for this program. And I'm a white male brought up in Bay Area in San Francisco. And I was exposed in Boston to a film by the name of Sankofa. And I saw one of the first screenings of it in a group of people in Roxbury, and it was one of the most impacting events of my life. And I don't know if you've seen that film. It's a beautiful, beautiful piece about slavery and the fact that there were so many different cultural elements to it that were all jammed together on these plantations. And it's a beautiful film. I just wanted to mention that and ask you if you've seen it. And also, Liverpool has an incredible museum dedicated to slavery that if anybody has the means to get there, it is a remarkable, another remarkable event in my life was to walk through that museum. It's three floors of information that is just impacting to anybody who has a heart and curiosity.
You're talking about Liverpool in England, in the UK.
England. It's a remarkable. I met people there from all over the world that were on pilgrimages to go there and experience that space. But Sankofa, have you?
Do you know the film? Yeah.
I don't know. I haven't seen that film. Though that word Sankofa is incredibly important, I think, to Ghanaian identity. That idea of having to look back before you can move forward, and I think that that's really one of the guiding principles of this book.
That's what writers have to do anyway, right?
Yeah, exactly.
The nature of composition of a fictional work or a novel. So good to have you with us. Appreciate the time that you have spent with us and appreciate your novel. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And that's Yaa Jessie. Again, her book is called Homegoing, a debut novel. And we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. You can, of course, and we encourage you to do so, continue this discussion online by going to kqed.org. I want to mention who's behind the scenes here, because it's always important to know the members of this team that bring you what we like to think of as high-quality program every day. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Larberg. Our engineers are Katie McMurrin and Danny Bringer. Our engagement editor is Amanda Stupai. We get online support from Amanda Font. Senior editor is Dan Zolt. Our executive producer is Joanne Wallace. Thank you for being a part of today's program and for all of us here at KQED Public Radio. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.